knowledge fight. Dan and Jordan, I am sweating. KnowledgeFight.com. It's time to pray.
I have great respect for Knowledge Fight.
Knowledge Fight. I'm sick of them posing as if they're the good guys, saying we are the bad guys. Knowledge Fight.
Dan and Jordan.
Knowledge Fight.
I need money. Andy in Kansas. Stop it. Andy in Kansas. It's time to pray. Andy in Kansas, you're on the air. Thanks for holding.
Hello, Alex. I'm a first-time caller. I'm a huge fan. I love your work.
Knowledge Fight.
KnowledgeFight.com. I love you.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Knowledge Fight. I'm Dan.
I'm Jordan.
We're a couple dudes like to sit around, worship at the altar of Celine, and talk a little bit about Alex Jones.
Oh, indeed we are, Dan.
Jordan.
Dan.
Jordan.
Quick question for you.
What's up?
What's your bright spot today?
My bright spot today, Jordan, is, as we all know, last year we celebrated the Dreamy Creamy Summer.
That's true.
Mustered the energy to do it this year again. But as people may recall, the winner, the unofficial winner, because there wasn't really a contest going on per se, but the best, most consistent ice cream brand that you can get in these stores and everything,
sure,
was Cool House, H-A-U-S.
Yes.
I found pretty much everything except for their mint chip fantastic.
They screwed up a mint chip?
It was a little toothpaste-y.
Oh, you can't screw up a mint chip.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. Calm down.
But all their other stuff was great. The horchata flavor is fantastic. The churros, great.
Wow.
But they have a new animal-free thing, ice cream sandwich.
Uh-huh.
It's a cookie dough, chocolate chip cookie dough.
Okay.
And, like, it's nuts. Like, thinking about this, there's no animal product in
no
it
animal
at all.
Product in a chocolate chip cookie dough ice cream sandwich.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that is you wouldn't think that it would be good. You know? We've come so far. From the days of when I was younger, where, like, all these things that were, like, vegan or all this, like, they'd just be no good. You couldn't imagine dairy that had no animal
product.
Right,
because it would taste terrible, and it did.
I'm actually looking at this now, and I'm realizing that maybe there is animal product in the cookies.
I was going to say, there's no way that there is not.
No, it says animal-free ice cream sandwich.
All right.
But then it also just says animal-free dairy. What is it?
Ooh, now I'm confused.
Okay, welcome to our world of dreamy, creamy, and indulgent animal-free ice cream that will guarantee to be unlike it. It doesn't say whether or not the cookies have
animal. Oh, there's totally horse parts
in there.
On the
box, it says lactose-free, animal-free, earth-friendly.
All right, well.
But if you... It would,
I'm telling you, there's
you couldn't
horse,
get away with
there
that.
There are horse parts in there.
You couldn't get away with that if it was like, all right, we got dairy-free ice cream, but the patties are beef.
Yeah, exactly.
We got two beef patties and dairy-free ice cream. You're confusing me.
Animal-free.
Anyway, Cool House, fantastic. I bought a box of three of them, and they're great.
Nice.
What's your bright spot?
My bright spot is a new album. Waiting For Me. I have not listened to it yet, but I am very excited.
Oh, is it Carly Rae Jepsen's new album that's coming out?
Sigur Rós.
Oh, okay.
Sigur Rós, Atta.
Attaboy.
I believe his name. Attaboy is unfortunately what you are going to call it forever.
Yep.
but yeah, I'm excited to listen to it. I didn't know if we were going to get another actual Sigur Rós album.
I feel like we got a new one like six weeks ago.
That was the remastering of Odin's Raven Magic, which was a weird opera night.
I must have like a vague memory of you bringing it up.
Yeah. I was there.
Oh, that's right. You went to a show.
Okay.
So these are all the things that I'm conflating.
These are all the things. But yeah, so new album. Their drummer is gone because he was credibly accused of sexual assault.
Okay.
And so he's gone.
See you later.
So I kind of didn't know if the Sigur Rós band actually was going to, you know, they all make music still.
Right.
But they made another album together, and I'm interested to hear what it sounds
new
like.
New drummer?
I don't know.
Oh, boy.
I don't even know if they've... I mean, you know, it is like now... If you're a band with only three members and none of them are a drummer, you'll just hire drummers to play.
True. But as I recall, Sigur Rós is all about the drums.
No.
I'm just making this up. I have no idea.
No, I mean, the drums are a really propulsive force for especially Untitled. Mm-hmm. That is a drum heavy album.
Okay.
Drum heavy album. Tak is not so drum heavy.
Okay.
Agita's Burgeon, definitely not that drum heavy.
Sure.
Although there are a couple of huge drum tracks. Oh, man. I love Sigur Rós so much.
I feel the same way about Carly Rae Jepsen, and her new album is coming out this week. So get ready for that next week.
Yay!
That's a bright spot. So, Jordan, today we have an episode to go over. Mm-hmm. We're going to be talking about the past.
Yeah.
I took a jump to the past because I needed a break. I've teased what is going to be happening on this episode. And I think people will remember, but who knows if Jordan does. But before we find out, let's take a little moment to say hello to some new wonks.
That's a great idea.
Okay. So first, Jay and Emily, happy anniversary. Sorry we're 2 months late. Thank you so much. You are now a policy wonk.
I'm a policy wonk.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, Dan's jump fart. Thank you so much. You are now a policy wonk.
I'm a policy wonk.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, garbage goblin, raccoon queen, she-dog of anarchy, Natalie. Thank you so much. You are now a policy wonk.
I'm a policy wonk.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, Kevin, it's Andrew. As of June 2nd, you still haven't told me about your experience in occupied Texas. Also, Dan and Jordan is Starfleet the Globalists and Terra Prime the Info Warriors. Thank you so much. You are now a policy wonk.
I'm a policy wonk.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Yes.
Next, Amber, I'm sorry I peed on the floor, but I've got to stop doing violence to pillows. Thank you so much. You are now a policy wonk.
I'm a policy wonk.
Thank you very much.
I'm upset about that.
I think that one's about a cat.
I hope so.
Yeah. That
seems like things that cats would do.
Yeah, yeah. They're doing violence to pillows. I don't know. Yeah.
Yep.
Don't ask me.
Okay.
Okay.
I won't.
Okay.
We got a technocrat in the mix, though, Jordan. So thank you so much to Ashton in Hawaii. You are now a technocrat. Aloha. Mahalo.
I'm a policy wonk.
4 stars. Go home to your mother and tell her you're brilliant.
Someone sodomite sent me a bucket of poop.
Daddy Shark. Bom, 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 bom. Jar Jar Binks has a Caribbean black accent.
He's a loser little titty baby.
I don't want to hate black people. I renounce Jesus Christ.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Jordan, do you know how to say Merry Christmas in Hawaiian?
No.
There's a song. That
oh, yeah?
Could help you remind it.
I don't know. I don't know why the joke song that I came up in my head was like Deutschland über alles. I don't know why that happened.
Mele Kaliki Maka.
Ah, yes. That's the thing
Mele
to say.
Mele Kaliki Maka is Hawaii's way. Do you know what their state fish is?
Large fish.
No.
Salmon.
Humu humu nuku nuku apua'a.
Ah. That is why you remember it.
Yep. Because you practice saying it a bunch.
You have to.
When you're young, like a wagadugu.
I was about to bring up a wagadugu.
Oh, fun diphthongs. You know, those two vowels next to each other.
Indeed.
Fun.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm using that word correctly, but it's a fun word. Anyway, we're in the past, and here's an out of context drop from today's show.
But for the next 10 minutes or so, I want to talk to Kevin Smith, who I appreciate coming on the show.
What?
Snoochie Boochies.
What? That's right. Oh, my God.
Kevin Smith from the Viewers universe.
What is happening? No, what year are we in?
It's a different Kevin Smith.
It's 2004, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's an employee that he has named Kevin Smith.
Oh, man. Because if it was him, this would have been right after Dogma, right?
Maybe.
I think this would have been right around that time. That would have been a great time for him to come on InfoWars.
I feel like it was definitely before he started smoking weed all the time.
Yeah, that's probably true.
So let me see. Let me see what year Dogma hit those theaters. Dogma was 1999.
Holy shit. Dogma was 99?
Yeah.
How old are we?
We're pretty old.
Are we dead?
We're pretty old.
Have we died? What just happened here?
Yeah, I feel like this definitely makes sense. That was a pre-9/11 film.
Yeah, that was definitely a pre-9/11 film. In retrospect, yes, 100%.
Let me see where Kevin Smith, the artiste, was at this point in time. Says before the weed, before the smodcast, before 2004, Jersey Girl came out in 2004.
Jersey Girl, oh boy,
yeah. So he could have gone on a promotional tour for InfoWars for Jersey Girl. Yeah, him and Ben Affleck show up. I can see it.
All right.
Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back also had come out since Dogma.
Ah,
so
gotcha.
You were way off.
Way off.
Way off. Anyway, way off. It's not Kevin Smith.
Okay.
It's, and we're not going to listen to the employee Kevin Smith at all because it's boring as hell.
Yeah.
But it's fun.
It is fun.
I worked at a movie theater with a guy named Kevin Smith once, and we, you know, made all the same jokes.
It's fun. It's fun to do.
Yep. So here is the beginning of the show here. We're starting. We're doing February 25th through 27th.
Okay.
And so we're starting here on the 25th.
I'm going to see The Passion today, and tomorrow I will have a review for you. I've already had a review from several people that have seen it, including Mel Gibson's father here on the show, but I'll actually get a chance to see it, and I'm really looking forward to it. I hope you all go out and watch it as well.
So, yeah, he's going to go see The Passion. It's coming out. It's in theaters.
I appreciate this saga in InfoWars time, I believe, should be called The Passion of the Passion of the Christ.
Yes, yes.
You know, like, it is a nonstop struggle for this movie to get through the day.
The Hutton of the of the InfoWars, yes, or something. Exactly. Yeah, Hutton Gibson just keeps coming up.
yep.
So, yeah, as we all know, my favorite genre of, you know, InfoWars stuff is movie Alex review. Doing movie reviews.
Amazing.
This is not one of them.
Because he hasn't seen it yet, right?
But we're covering the day after.
Oh!
And so I'm just giving you a heads up. It's not going to be like his movie reviews.
What?
He just says it's great and he cried. That's basically it. Yeah.
That means it wasn't that good and there wasn't any starships or explosions.
And he didn't cry, but he did get nachos.
Yeah.
So Alex does have a guest, although it is not Kevin Smith.
Okay.
You're not going to want to miss this interview in the second hour. I really appreciate Don coming on the show. Highly decorated Korean War veteran, shot twice in Korea, in OSS even before that, right out of high school during World War II, right after World War II, and a long military career after that, and an expert on the New World Order. I've read a lot of his writings. I've never interviewed him. So that interview, interview should be quite interesting.
It's Don DeGrand Prix. Don DeGrand Prix is on. He's never been on before.
Oh,
it's
boy.
His first appearance. Alex has, he says a lot of times that he had a stroke a year ago, but he's doing fine, which he says it like probably 4 or 5 times.
Yeah.
Which is a little excessive.
Well, that makes sense then why people keep asking about him.
Well, that was quite a ways down the line. That was many, many years later.
Sure.
Also, Alex doesn't really know who he is and keeps calling him Don DeGrand. And he gets corrected at some point. So we've talked a little bit about Don DeGrand Prix in the past, because how could you not? It's a fun name.
It's a fun name.
But I decided I'd give him a little bit of a closer examination this time around. As it turns out, he wrote a series of books called The Barbarians Inside the Gates, with the subtitles The Serpent's Sting, Viper's Venom, and Rattler's Revenge.
Oh my God, this is going to be fucking anti-Semitic, isn't it? God damn it.
I found a copy of Serpent Sting available online on the website of America First Books, which also celebrates the legacy of people like David Duke and Kevin Alfred Strom.
Yeah.
And is a thoroughly anti-Semitic outlet full of Holocaust denial.
Yeah, yeah.
The prologue of Don DeGrand Prix's book is mostly him insisting that he is not anti-Semitic, and then he goes and says this. First, he cites a Time magazine editorial where the author is discussing the fear of an impending conflict between Israel and Palestine, where she says, quote, both sides know two things in advance of another fight. Israel will win it, and it will be horribly painful. In response to this, Don says, quote, therein, in that succinct statement, is the heart of the troubles and misery of civilization over the past 3,000 years, all perpetuated by a biblical band of outcasts, which history records as the tribes of Judah and Benjamin, with their maniacal thirst for destruction and revenge forever. Yeesh. He goes on to say that the introduction of the concept of anti-Semitism was done solely to make people afraid to criticize the people running the world, and that the Holocaust was faked, quote, to seek the sympathy of the populations of the UK, US, and Canada.
Makes sense to me. Tracks.
To sum up what I read, he's incredibly anti-Semitic and spends a lot of time trying to discredit the idea of anyone being called anti-Semitic.
Yeah.
For instance, from his book Serpent's Sting, he says this, quote, a standard Zionist Bolshevist modus operandi is to scream anti-Semite at anyone who exposes any of their nefarious plans, and to seek the, quote, sympathy factor by staging, quote, incidents such as the desecration of their own cemeteries or torching their own synagogues and blaming it on, quote, neo-Nazis. makes quite an argument.
A lot of scare quotes in there, I see.
Yes. Sympathy factor, incidents, neo-Nazis.
I think you're saying something more than what you're saying.
So I've read a fair amount of his writing in advance of doing this episode, and I find it difficult to imagine reading his stuff and not getting the sense that Don has a problem with Jewish people. Alex is saying he's read Don's work, which leads me towards the conclusion that Alex is aware of Don's Holocaust denial and anti-Semitism, and that's just not a problem for him.
Yeah.
Or he's lying about having read any of his stuff and is just willing to, you know, have this guy with a wacky name come on.
Yeah, yeah. Two things can be true. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go with, you just don't know in this time period whether or not he's read something within the past 10 years.
Yeah, I'm guessing no. Well, he's read something probably.
Exactly.
But not Don DeGrandpre's
doubtful
ridiculous writing.
Serpent Sting.
Also, I do think that he was enlisted.
Okay.
So he's not faking all of this.
Right.
But I do think he's also exaggerating a great deal of his bio.
Uh-huh.
And to me, he seems like a proto-Steve.
Yeah.
He seems like another... He has a lot of big swings.
Yeah.
A lot of claims that he... Like, one of the things he claims in this episode is that one of his good friends was part of the Nebraska Air Guard that shot down United 93.
Sure.
So he knows the guy personally.
You always got to know everybody.
Yeah. And Alex asks, like, how did you find that out? He's like, oh, it turns out it was an old buddy of mine. Like, whatever, man. So, but there's that kind of big brag.
Sure.
That you usually see from Steve.
Yeah.
Coming from him.
All right.
And it's kind of fun.
Okay.
So Don DeGrandpre came into prominence within 9/11 communities a little bit after 9/11 when he had a marathon symposium. This is very Mike Lindell-ish.
I'm hearing you loud and clear.
He had a 72-hour straight symposium.
Sure.
With a bunch of pilots trying to get to the bottom of what happened on 9/11.
Okay.
And so they talk about this here a little bit.
If you have some questions, fire away, Alex.
Well, now, you got these military officers together, and then I guess the only place I ever saw it get reported on was here in Portugal, talked about the symposium. Of course, I've read one of your fine books, and we'll talk about that as well a little bit later in the show and take some calls. But what was laid out, what I saw in the four-page article 2 years ago, has turned out to be very accurate. Tell us about the military officers, the pilots, the civilian pilots that were there, and the conclusions you came to in the 72-hour nonstop meeting. Please go over that for us.
Okay, Alex.
Okay,
Alex.
72-hour nonstop meeting about 9/11 sounds like hell.
I can't think of anything less interesting to me
mm-hmm.
than a bunch of people for 72 hours.
You'd be hallucinating towards
absolutely,
the end.
Absolutely.
You'd be like, what is happening? You'd accept any kind of wacky conclusion.
Of course.
Yeah.
A bunch of pilots are shouting random pilot nonsense at me about planes and how the buildings don't work like that.
So some of the things that I know about Don DeGrandpre's conclusions about 9/11 that Alex is signing off on here and saying he agrees with his conclusions are that Israel did it.
That
the planes were military aircraft and they were remote controlled into the towers.
Okay.
And that the commercial jets that were supposed to be those planes,
sure.
they were placed somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean, but Don doesn't know where it is and no one has ever found them.
Okay.
So those are the conclusions that Alex is signing off on.
Okay.
Here.
So if I understand correctly, all right, here is the plan to 9/11.
Right.
All right. We've got these planes.
Mm-hmm.
We can't use them
because right.
they need pilots and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we have to build remote-controlled exact replicas of those planes. But if people look for those planes, we have to make sure that they can't find them. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they'll know that we made replicas of the planes. So we just put them under the ocean?
Yeah. I don't see any problems here. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm just asking to sign off.
That's how one would do it.
Just asking for the boss to sign off.
Yeah.
This is how.
Check.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I'll go get it done then.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I don't buy it. But it's fun that Alex is just like, yes, this is what happened.
100%.
So Don and the pilots, they got together. They had this 72-hour no sleep. Symposium marathon,
mm-hmm.
and they figured it out, and they came together and made a 24-page report.
Okay.
Now, Don fancies himself to be the best friend of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Uh-huh.
Wait, you had your hand up.
I was just saying, is everything done in the rule of threes now? Is everything divisible by three? 72 hours, 24 pages.
Yeah.
Three people will speak today. Yeah. Sorry.
9/11, divisible by three.
Ooh.
I don't think it is. Might be. No, it's not. 900 and 9/11? No, definitely not. So they get this 24-page report.
Yeah.
Don thinks that he's really good friends with the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and so he sends it to them, and he thinks that he got a really positive response.
Interesting.
Please go over that for us.
Okay, Alex, the group of pilots, and they will remain anonymous, were a wonderful mix of commercial, military, and civilian pilots. At any rate, after 3 days, the decisions were unanimous, and I wrote my 24-page report up and submitted it to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And that report ultimately got into the hands of the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs on 23 January 2002. The general was a U.S. Marine Corps general by the name of Peter Pace. And I got a telephone call 5 March from his horse, one of his horse holders, who is a colonel, Air Force type, and he informed me that General Peter Pace had gotten the 24 pages and that he, in effect, had no comment at this time, but he used the old Marine Corps lingo, semper fi, or always faithful.
So this is what he hangs his hat on in terms of, like, this Peter Pace, the
right.
vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff,
right.
giving him the wink. He said semper fi, and so that means that, like, I can't say anything, but I'm totally into this.
I mean, isn't that probably also how he, like, signs off on his emails? And
I would almost
guarantee. Well, I mean, 100,000%.
Especially if it's a communique with somebody else who is served.
Yes.
You know, like, it seems meaningless,
it's,
almost.
It's like, no, I mean, it's like, have a pleasant day. But, you know, you're in the military. You can't be like, have a pleasant day. You have to say, semper fi.
Right. I think it's a sign-off that is inconspicuous and doesn't have a lot of meaning. But for Colonel Don de Grand Prix, we have
confirmation that the highest levels know exactly what's going on.
And they're on board.
And they're on his team.
Yeah, totally.
Or at the very least, underground, they're on his team.
So
they can't go public yet.
Right. Absolutely not. And that's why it appears that no one knows who Don de Grand Prix is.
it appears that so very well.
Yeah.
It's a perfect illusion.
This is one of the, like, the message discipline across the Army
in terms
of not knowing who
zero whistleblowers. Absolutely no leaks on this.
No crack in the facade. Brilliant acting.
Amazing.
So yeah, the chair, Peter Pace, apparently made 500 copies of Don's report.
Okay.
And Alex asks, like, for details about this, and I will say that Don's story is shaky.
Okay.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs had 500 copies of this 24-page report made and sent out, including the White House. And I have to say it was including President Bush.
Now,
so they got a copy of the report.
That was Myers at the time.
That is correct.
And so, I mean, if he sent out 500 copies, that would mean that he believed in it.
I'm quite sure that he believed in it, and I think that he still believes in it. You can understand the difficulties. Administration, the civilian administration, of course, won't recognize it as such.
How did you find out that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs had sent this out?
I got a telephone call, and I think the date was 5 March 2002, stating that at the time, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs had no comment, but he used the Marine Corps lingo, semper fi. Semper fidelity, always faithful. And that triggered in me further memos, and I traded memos with General Peter Pace and Dick Myers, and they continued on
well, that
until
had to be
November of last year.
Well, that had to be upsetting to Mr. Rumsfeld to have all these, you know, hundreds of your report flying around the Pentagon.
Yeah, there, you see, there's a definite cleavage between the military of the Pentagon and the civilian hierarchy, and never the twain shall meet.
I will say that Rumsfeld put on quite a brave face.
Yeah.
In you know, dealing with this,
you
with
know,
Don DeGrand Pries, almost uprising, quite frankly.
After watching a documentary entirely about Donald Rumsfeld, where they looked directly into his eyes, I don't think he was bothered by much of anything at all.
No.
I think he might be a true psycho.
Yeah. And in April 2005, Peter Pace, the guy that he's supposedly trading stuff with, became the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chair of it.
Ouch.
So I don't think that he was on the outs with anybody in the administration.
No.
Like, Bush nominated him.
And gave him a promotion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So he would have been the conduit by which Myers got the report that made the 500 copies.
We've got a new wrinkle.
Okay,
now we've got a new wrinkle. He gets promoted immediately after receiving this specific information.
No, he was
rewarded for suppressing it.
3 years later.
Exactly.
So in 2002, you got to remember, morale low.
Oh.
Real low.
Oh.
And so... I will say that based on what Don says here, I'm pretty glad that there's civilian control of the military.
Right after the events you talk about, in mid-2002, the Washington Times saying the morale at the Pentagon had never been lower. And you would think it would be high, you know, after 9/11 and, you know, getting together to fight the enemy. But it said that the officers didn't believe in the, quote, mission. Or in the intelligence.
That is correct. That came out of the Washington Times, and I can verify that from Colonel Dick Schultz, who is a friend of mine in the Joint Chiefs. Morale was not only low, but he said some of the troops are ready to mutiny, and if it wasn't for the fact that the government, the civilian hierarchy, has control over retirements, etc., they'd probably be blood in the streets by now.
That was what was stopping it? Retirements?
Right. Pensions.
Yeah.
Pensions.
But if you okay, here, that's stupid. Here's why. If you're willing to mutiny to the point where there's blood in the streets, you're going to die or you're going to succeed in your objective.
Right.
I don't think you're worried about your retirement plan as it stands, because if you succeed, you could create your own retirement plan. And if you fail, you're dead.
I know. So. I know this makes sense. I know it doesn't make sense to you, but I swear to you, it makes perfect sense. In all honesty, like teachers.
No.
Will get to the point after like 20 years, they will not talk about students. They won't talk about their lives. They'll just be like, "Here's the number of years left I have until I get my pension."
I understand that.
I care about nothing else.
I'm talking about a bloody coup.
Sure. You think a school couldn't feel one of those?
I could see how it might feel at times that a classroom is like there's blood on the streets and, you know, it's like a insurrection against the U.S. government. But I think if people had been all armed on January 6th, I think a lot more people would have died.
Yeah.
If they were coming in shooting into the Capitol.
Yeah, that would have gone bad.
Right.
Yeah,
if what he's describing is not analogous to your...
No, absolutely not. It was
It's just dumb. But it is the kind of thing that you might say to someone like him if you didn't want to agree with him and like join up, like, the reason nothing's happening is that you got to worry about your pension.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you going to do?
Yeah.
Hey, listen, I would have a body count in the thousands by now, but they hold my pension.
Yeah. It seems like a good excuse and conversation ender.
Yeah.
If you're hanging out with Don DeGrand Prix.
Hey, I think we should probably, let's cause some real havoc. Oh, yeah. Oh, you know, I would. Mm. Oh, I'd mutiny.
But on the off chance that Don DeGrand Prix is right, let's keep those retirements under the control
let's
of the
sure
civilian
let's
government.
Let's make sure we do that. Let's make sure we do that.
So I said that... Don's a little bit Stevie, a little Pachenicky.
Sure.
And you might get a little bit of that sense here.
So we're in a world of hurt, Alex.
Now, by coup d'etat, do you mean another intensification of a reverse coup d'etat to keep the people from fighting against the New World Order? Or do you mean the type that Bill Clinton successfully stopped in his administration?
Well, I'm talking about the administrative coup d'etat that came off September 11th.
You're talking about an intensification.
September 11th.
You're talking about an intensification of the elite in a coup d'etat against America.
That is correct.
Well, I mean, it's ongoing. They're federalizing everything. They're militarizing everything. They're engaging in the classic takeover, are they not?
Yes, they are. And from this, Alex, and I bring this out very clearly in Book 3, the only way we can stop it is with the classic counter coup d'etat.
Classic.
Where the military steps in.
Classic.
And under the aegis of the military itself, disengaging or disemboweling the civilian hierarchy and taking over and rerunning and reorganizing the federal government.
That goes so well.
Now, the problem is they've got so many CFR minions in the Pentagon.
That's the problem.
We know that Clinton had some officers terminated in their offices, you know, shot multiple times and the rest of it. We know that happened. The question is, how many of the high-level officers are on the globalist team?
I can only say several of the highest level are members now of the Council of Foreign Relations.
Well, we're going to take all of them out, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's got it. They got to go.
So, yeah, we're gonna, he wants like a military coup, basically, but it's a counter coup.
Sure.
In the same way that the 2016 election was contextualized for Alex. You know, there's almost a mirror parallel between this.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, 9/11 was the coup that these people committed, and then we're just doing a counter coup.
Yeah, it is. It is fun to watch people feel like they're having a conversation with the news or what or whatever. Mm. You know, we're having
the Joint
a conversation.
Chiefs?
Yeah, or no, I mean more like okay, in response to 9/11, we're going to perform a coup, right? Mm. That doesn't make sense. You can't do that. What you have to do is say, aha, 9/11 was a coup, so I'm not doing a coup.
9/11,
I'm doing the right thing.
9/11 was the event that like catalyzed the administrative coup within the government.
Right.
Yeah, now we're trying to bring it back.
Yeah, yeah. We're not mad about the... No. It's not that the stuff is bad before or anything. It's completely different now. There's an administrative coup that we all know about because it's... you can't avoid it.
Yeah.
Right? It's in your face all the time.
I think what bothers me more is the way that this is so similar to stuff in, you know, the Trump election.
Yeah.
I don't enjoy it when stuff that big is reruns, kind of. You know, but it is.
Yeah, I mean, 20 years should be longer. Mm-hmm. 20 years should be a lot longer. You know, like, we can joke about how old dogma is, but, I mean, the dogma of the right shouldn't be the same. You know, I mean, it's unfortunate that wordplay happened, and I apologize for it.
But that would be like somebody making dogma again and pretending the first one didn't happen. That's what we're doing.
Yeah,
that's
basically
what he's doing.
Yeah. Ugh,
God, it's just infuriating.
It's so annoying.
So Don has a little story about Wolfowitz.
Okay.
Do you think the globalists are going to have the will to carry out another massive attack here in the U.S. to try to get control back over the population and get their agenda back on track? Or do you think they've computed, as you said, that will blow up in their face because so many people now know who the real terrorists are?
Well, that's a two-pronged question, Alex. I think it deserves a studied answer. The only thing I can say is I'm not sure of how it'll turn out, but it's very dangerous.
Well, I don't, from watching the globalist, I think they had a plan. They're still following a plan, but I think they're shook up. I think from the evidence, in fact, I know from the evidence, a lot of things they planned haven't gone according to schedule, and so they don't know what to do right now.
This is correct. I think it's personified in the persona of the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz. They almost got him in Baghdad when they fired the salvo one night of weaponry, and they scared Paul Wolfowitz off. He's ready to resign or
you think
get
that
the hell
was,
out.
Do you think that was U.S. forces doing that?
I believe it. It was very well
That's a swing.
Again. And,
there we go.
And only U.S. forces would know that he would be there, yeah.
Yeah.
That is correct.
Yeah. So, yeah, the U.S. forces tried to blow up Paul Wolfowitz.
Tried to kill the wolf.
Yeah.
all right.
Saying okay. this with just, I believe this to be true. Is the your backup for it? All right. I'm going to go ahead and say no.
I'm not impressed, but there is a certain level of yes-anding that I think they achieve just by virtue of actually trying to live in the reality.
The reality that they're constructing around themselves at all times.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like that yes-anding is so incredibly like, oh, of course.
Yeah, even if you have to contradict the last thing that was said,
the
agree
very last
and then
thing.
Contradict.
Yeah, the very last thing that was said.
Yeah.
The last sentence.
Or else you're going to run into too much conflict and it's no good.
Amazing.
So Don, his interview, not all that interesting outside of these little bits. They agree to stay in touch, so we'll see more of Don de Grand Prix.
Mm-hmm.
Not anymore, but in the past we were.
Right.
Because I got bad news.
Oh, is he okay?
He's not.
Oh, shit.
So the rest of the show, Alex takes calls, and we just have one here that is of note.
Yeah, I've been on hold for a while. I've already kind of switched subjects like this, but talking about the Passion.
Oh, yes, the Passion of Christ.
Right, the movie. I had a question. I've known in the past that you've talked about people who do these movies like the skulls, and you kind of paint a picture that it's, you know, it's some agenda to take away from the legitimacy of the argument. And I wonder, when you talk about conspiracy theory, that's also a Mel Gibson movie, that you don't kind of put it in those same terms. And really, my point is,
I'm not going to tell you what I know about Mel Gibson, but I know a lot of, you know, private stuff, and I know the family, and I've met a lot of the family, and I'm not going to go
all
any further.
Jews.
But Mel Gibson's the real deal and knows as much as I do about the New World Order and, you know, listens to these shows, watches my videos, knew about the New World Order when I was in diapers. Mel Gibson's the real deal. Colonel, you have any comments about Mel Gibson?
I know him personally, and I know his father, Hutton, who's a dear friend of mine. He was originally from San Antonio, Texas. And now Hutton has moved to West Virginia. He's still very active at 85.
Oh, Don, you and Hutton are friends? What do you possibly have in common?
I have two very specific details, thus proving everything that I have said so far.
I wouldn't be too surprised if he and Hutton are friends. They're both big Holocaust deniers.
No, they would be friends.
Yeah.
They would like each other at
Certainly.
The very least. Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. I feel like that's one I can kind of believe is possible.
Sure.
Hutton seems accessible.
Yeah.
He's friends with Alex-ish.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're a famous anti-Semite after growing in popularity after 9/11, then yeah, Hutton's gonna be like, "Whoa, serpents, I'm in."
Yeah. So I thought that was an interesting parallel.
Yeah,
Don and Don de Grand Prix hanging out with Hutton Gibson. Wow,
what a world!
It is a closed circle
of
anti-Semites.
What a world!
Yeah, so Alex saw The Passion that day, and February 26th, he comes into the studio and he wants to just take calls on it. He wants to talk about The Passion.
Yeah, let's just talk about it.
All right, my friends, it's now Thursday, the 26th day of February 04. I saw The Passion of the Christ last night. It was an excellent film, and I'll give you my review of it. And in fact, we're going to open the phones up in the second segment of the show here in about 7 minutes. We're going to go right to your calls for those that have seen The Passion or would like to comment on the media's spin about the film. We'll go directly to your calls at 1-800-259-9231. That's 1-800-259-9231. Just talking to Scott, who's running the show. He saw a pre-screening of it last night and said he thought it was a great film. I mean, there are many movies that are, quote, more violent. You know, hundreds of people being killed, demons ripping people's guts out. The Passion is historical. You know, they had a rabbi on television on Scarborough Country going, this is historical. The Jewish historians, the Roman historians told the same story. This is what happened to the most famous individual in world history, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so Alex liked it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do think that it is a fair point that there have been other movies that are more violent. That being said,
yeah.
The Passion of the Christ is grotesquely violent.
Is it? I don't remember it. I know
you're watching
I must have
Jesus
seen
get his ass kicked the whole
sure,
time.
Sure,
it's like 2.5 hours of blood.
No, and I know why people get reacted to that. But you know, I was raised in this. I saw Christ die so many times.
Sure.
I saw Christ die all day.
Yeah, I think it's a more graphic depiction than is often made, and it's gratuitous.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
I mean, just from a film standpoint.
Sure, sure.
It's a lot. Alex talks a lot about the Cat o' Nine Tails and how it rips flesh off and stuff.
Oh, so it's very torture-y.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay.
It makes a point. I mean, obviously, in the best interpretation you can have, it's that it wants to, bring to the forefront the minutiae and the reality of the pain that Christ went through.
Sure, sure. He died for your sins. You should know what it felt like for him to die for your sins. That's the point. What? Nope.
Yeah. I can understand where someone who believes that might be coming from. But as a viewer, I found that aspect of the film to be difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a lot. It was very violent and intimately violent.
Yeah, that's creepy.
Mm-hmm.
When you have that kind of violence in a reverential way, then you kind of glorify the violence maybe as much as you do the guy.
The argument that is made on Alex's show is actually that it's an anti-violence film. And not only that, Alex believes that cops that go see it will be less likely to be rough with people. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Rough with people they're arresting because they'll see the violence and...
All right, well, let's go to the future real quick. All right, how are we doing with the less violent cops, Dan?
I don't have any study that tracks before and after seeing Passion of the Christ, so I can't comment on this, though police brutality has not been solved.
All right, well, we can go best through the past, then.
Okay. So there, one of the things that is like the cornerstone of the argument about this is it's all biblical.
Sure.
This is, that's why sometimes these Jewish people come off looking really terrible, because I have to be literally accurate to the word of the Bible. So that's the whole thing, the song and dance that Mel and Alex have been doing.
Right.
Unfortunately, there are some creative licenses.
I was going to say.
And there were maybe two or three things in there that were license of the writers, Mel Gibson, and the director, Mel Gibson. You know, there wasn't really a crow there, trying to pull the eyeball out of one of the people on the cross. But other than that, just a few other things. Just amazing
you don't
film,
know that.
Very moving. You don't have a heart if you don't cry. I mean, I couldn't help it. I just love Jesus Christ, and it was. But even if I wasn't a Christian, it would have brought me to tears. And I saw a 3:30 showing. It was jam-packed. The entire theater was full.
Yeah, it's a good environment to see something emotionally.
Does everybody cheer when he dies? They have to cheer, right? You have to cheer. I think you have to cheer when Jesus dies.
I feel like the resurrection is more what you cheer about.
They didn't show that in the movie, did
they?
You're
very solemn when he dies.
It's all the same.
I guess it is part of the process.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing. Alive, dead, he was always both. He's been alive before we were, he'll be alive after we were. We saw him die for a little bit, but even then, that was like a few days. Mm-hmm. In his lifetime, which is infinite,
mm-hmm.
That's practically a vacation. I bet he loved being dead.
How many days? 3.
Oh, shit.
We're back.
72 hours.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like this was thankfully just after I got out of church stuff.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I'm certain that I would have been, if I was just a few years younger, I would have been in my K-life and going to youth group stuff.
Yeah.
And been on the bus going to a screening and probably crying, you know, along with my friends.
I mean, I know I saw it in the theater. I know I went in a church bus. I know that I was shuttled there. I do not remember the movie or anyone available in those memories.
Yeah.
I have a bus.
I had discovered weed by this point.
Yeah.
And I was in college.
I think I was like, what, 17? Yeah.
No, because I think, so I would have.
2004 would have been 17 for me, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I guess I would have been 20.
Yeah. Well, you definitely discovered weed by then.
Yeah. Huh. For some reason, I thought I was 18. No, 2004. Yeah, that actually, I was, because my first year of college was a little bit shaky.
Yeah.
So I was fully in college by this point.
Gotcha.
And yeah, that thankfully, I missed that. Because I remember we went on a K-Life mission trip one time.
Ooh.
And it wasn't a hotel we were staying in, but it was like this big room, and then there were like other rooms with bunks and stuff, but like there was a center room.
Sure.
And one night the leaders brought out like a cross. And,
great.
Yeah. And then we sat by like candlelight, and then you were supposed to like confess a sin and then drive a nail into the cross. And I remember everyone crying, and I of course was right along. It was, that would have been the experience that I would have had if I would gone to the Passion of the Christ.
Totally.
I would have been sucked up and subsumed into the feeling of the group.
Oh, you can't argue. If you've been to the young Christian revivalist tent kind of shit, you cannot argue with being surrounded by other teenagers singing the same song and insanely horny out of your mind, but unable to do anything about it because you're at Christ camp, so you subsume all of that shit into, oh my God, God's real!
Yeah.
You know? That's how it goes.
There's a lot of angles on it, and I'm grateful that I missed the passion.
Yeah.
So, Alex believes that it's easy to give up your life for someone else. I don't believe him. I think he's an incredibly selfish asshole. But whatever.
Laying down your life for your brothers, your neighbors, your family, and for strangers is the most beautiful thing you can do. It takes so much strength and courage. But once you commit yourself to it, it's frankly not that hard. And instinctively, and the trials and tribulations that I've been through, it is actually rewarding to not sell out, to stand up against evil. And I would be honored someday to be chewed up by the New World Order and in the fight against it.
Might explain why he fetishizes consequences and pretends that they're a sign of his virtue.
Yeah.
But also, like, when I first heard that clip, and like when he was talking, I was just like, you idiot. You wouldn't give up your life for your neighbor. What the fuck are you talking about?
Kidding.
But then I'd kind of forgotten until I re-listened to it just now that this is in the context of The Passion of the Christ.
Yeah.
And so he's saying that giving your life for people is easy.
Yep.
So what Christ did was easy.
Didn't even have to struggle. It wasn't even that hard.
Alex,
you know those 40 days in the desert and stuff with the devil? Fucking great.
Yeah, ate
Chinese food the whole time.
One of the things that you would not come away from that movie with is, it was easy.
Come on. I'd do that tomorrow. What are we doing? Why'd we make this guy famous? That's the first thing that I would say walking out of the show. Who is this guy?
It's a weird thought for Alex to have on this day of any day.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's the same thing with like blaming the Jews for the death of Christ or anything. And it's like, man, the whole idea is that he was doing a thing.
Mm-hmm.
He had a whole thing going on. This was all the plan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the whole thing was part of the thing. So you can't be mad at any part of the thing.
All the things are required for the thing.
Exactly. So you can't be mad at the things. The thing is the thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. That is, and you know, that's the Judas argument.
Yeah.
You know, Judas didn't betray Jesus. He was part of fulfilling the plan.
He was just doing the job.
Isn't that the Gospel of Judas thing?
I don't know.
There's some extra.
Feel like it's logical in the words. It's like, oh, this was my plan. Mm-hmm. Then I guess all of it was the plan.
Fair enough. So Alex takes a lot of calls on this, and man. I mean, they're just all like, it's good. It's good stuff.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
Love it.
And there's not a whole lot of reason to listen to that a bunch. But one guy calls in and he is like, why would you call that movie historical?
Good question.
I like you. I like this. I like your world and all that, but that doesn't seem like the right word.
Good question.
Hey, Alex, this is Joe. Mm-hmm. You know, I called up in the past and I supported everything that you've done, opposing the New World Order, and when it comes time, you know, I will throw on my suit of armor and fight right beside
okay.
you.
Well, thank you.
I have a couple of comments, a couple of questions, and a lot of this actually even concerns me. I've been listening to you for a long time. I have all your tapes. I think they're great.
I know, but when somebody prefaces a call without you, I'm a big supporter of you. But, hey, go ahead and make your points, bud.
I don't want your other listeners to get the wrong idea. I do support you. And I've been listening to your show. And a lot of times people do call up and you say you want to stick to the facts. You don't want to talk about hypotheticals, only things that you can prove. And the whole beginning of the show, I've been hearing this is a historical event when... And let me make my whole comment here. This is a historical event. This actually did happen. When really, Alex, it's always good to have faith. I do believe in a creator. However, there really isn't enough documented evidence that I have seen, other than a Bible, that actually supports the theory or the historical life or birth of Christ.
Well,
Let me talk. Put him on hold.
We have a dialogue here, and I get to talk too.
With you on hold.
That's saying, I've never seen George Washington. Where's the proof? Or I've never seen, Caligula. Caligula did live, and there were a whole bunch of Jewish historians, Roman historians. It's a true story. So just because you haven't bothered to look for the evidence and don't know about archaeology or history, which I do, more than most people. I could certainly learn a lot more, but I'm interested in these things. Yes, when I'm covering the news or legislation, I stick to the facts. Yes, I'm a Christian because I have faith in what I believe in. Can you say that that's speculation? Yes. Okay? I mean, clearly, those two things are separate. And I don't have a, quote, religious show. You know, I don't sit here and have secular debates and fights and, get into all this. I'm talking about the passion. But now, go ahead now, and you can finish up.
So the I have my faith.
Clearly, and those two things are separate.
And the only thing you can say to that is, not anymore.
Fuck you.
Yeah. If that ever was the case,
yeah.
It is
yeah,
not.
Yeah, get that shit out of my face.
Yeah.
Good heavens.
Wow. I think that's a little bit disingenuous.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the caller, I mean, he has sort of the same issue that you were bringing up with the bird. Yeah. It's like, you weren't there.
How the fuck do you know?
Yeah. Huh. You don't know that a bird didn't poke at someone's eye.
Totally. Why not? Birds love to poke at dead people's eyes. I'd buy that more than I buy that Jesus came back to life. How about that?
Yeah. So I think that this caller also has a really good point that is still an issue with Alex's show, even as it comes to like the Sandy Hook trials and stuff. That is that he does not do a good job of delineating when he is doing X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
When are you reporting? When are you commenting? When are you making shit up? When are you pretending to do satire? Like, he doesn't do a good job of that. So you could hear him talking about how everything in this movie is historically accurate and be like, oh, this is news reporting that he's doing.
Right.
There's no way to know. There's no different hat that he puts on.
Right. Well, that's why Fox News got away with it so long in plain sight, is because they'd be like, aha, no. Our crazy right-wing opinion people only show up at 7. Mm-hmm. Until then, we're all very, very wise, very smart, regular people. Mm-hmm. Then we go crazy. Alex is like, I'm all at once. Yeah.
And you can never really know which is which.
And that's by design.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this caller, the same caller, eventually gets a little bit anti-Bible, and Alex isn't having it.
Uh-oh.
All right. Yeah, I can appreciate your comment. But what I want to say is, do you think for one moment that if a Bible had the power that everyone puts into this book, that the New World Order would give them out for free in every motel so that you can defeat their god?
Well, that
book would be in the bottom of the Vatican.
You know, it's funny.
With a lock on it so tight.
You know, it's funny.
That you wouldn't even know about that.
You know, it's funny. You ask a question and then you start talking. Hey,
well,
listen, I got to let you go. I got to let you go because what I said is, we're talking about the passion and we're taking calls. Some other day we can have this debate.
Or you can call back in the third hour after I rebroadcast this interview, because it's a very important interview, and we can talk more. You know, the Gideons paid to have Bibles put into churches and in hotel rooms and in other places. And that's what made America free, and that's what made 4% of the population
Gideons?
Have half the wealth. Now we're becoming decadent. We're losing the wealth. We're losing the freedom. We're losing the milk and honey. We're going back into bondage.
Yeah.
Well, then tell the Gideons to spend more on Bibles. And you've just clearly understood and diagnosed the problem.
Yeah, the Gideons right? aren't doing enough.
The Gideons were doing everything right, mm-hmm. and now they're not, so we need to get them back on board.
Yeah, stop slouching, Gideons.
Yeah, come on,
back
Gideons.
To work.
You put Bibles in hotels, and then everything got great, and now where we are.
Well, yeah. people stopped... being surprised by the Bible being there.
Oh, there's a Bible here. There, everybody knows about the Bible.
Or maybe there's less people who are at the end of their rope in hotel rooms. Who knows exactly what the situation is?
Not a lot of motel converts these days, I see.
I feel like it's really weird that... sentence that Alex had, that the Gideons put Bibles everywhere and that's what made America free.
I mean, it did come out of his mouth, mm-hmm. and he didn't take it back. Mm-mm. He said strongly and directly, the Gideons put Bibles everywhere and that's what made America free.
Yep.
Okay. Well, then fucking get to work, Gideons.
Yeah.
Jesus.
So Alex plays the interview that he did with Michael Shrimpton a couple days prior. He just replays that whole thing for the second hour.
Gotcha.
So that's that. Then he has a call here that I think is really illuminating.
Let's talk to Mildred in Colorado. Mildred, go ahead.
Hi, Alex. I was wondering what your definition of Zionist is.
Interesting.
I've been listening since the first of your show, and you were speaking then of being, of not being anti-Semitic. And,
that's right. I'm not against.
You spoke of someone who was anti-Zionist, and you seem to agree with them. And so I just needed to know your definition of Zionist.
Well, I'm against, say, Mecha, who says that they hate white people and blacks, or you know, anybody.
What's Mecha?
Ma'am, just let me answer your question, okay? I'm against Mecha because they say they don't like certain races and that they're the best. Okay, I'm against the Ku Klux Klan because they say that about whites. And Zionist, you know, the real King Daddy, a real Zionist, thinks that they're the best and everybody else is basically dog meat. And so that's who I'm talking about. And most Jews are not Zionists. So I'm against racist Jews. I'm against racist blacks. I'm against racist Germans. And so that's what I said.
You don't think Zionism means that you support Israel as a nation?
No, that's not what it means. If you really look at what the real Zionism is, it's a lot more than that. It means
the
domination by Israel of a certain group of people. I can have a bunch of rabbis up to tell you that if you'd like me to.
I would like for you to.
Okay, well, you better research what the Zionists say. I mean, they don't have a very good view of people who aren't Jewish. It's pretty racist.
Okay.
Pretty racist stuff.
So if the definition of Zionist were racist Jewish person,
sure,
then Alex would make some sense. I have to say,
yeah,
I'm pretty convinced that Alex's definition of Zionist is based on the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Yeah.
I think that what he's describing fairly well lines up with that being the writings that he's talking about,
mm-hmm.
And that troubles me.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Zionism and the word specifically is that because of the way that it's been used by everybody,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have a set, like, everybody agrees this is what Zion is.
Right.
You know?
People bring a lot of their own,
right.
like, ideas and feelings and
right.
To the table.
Which is why, interchangeably, Alex can use it with Semitism or whatever with his other white nationalist friends.
Mm-hmm.
Zionism is the same thing as being Jewish. So, yeah, throw that word in there, you know? But because it means something else to people outside of that space, Alex can then use that as being like, no, 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 no. See, that's why I'm not anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
When I say Zionism, I'm speaking specifically of something mm-hmm. when he's not. It's interchangeable.
And I would have a certain amount more respect for Alex's point that he's making if there was more of a feeling of, like, you know, concern about the Palestinians. And,
that
kind of a conversation of his, like, feelings of being against Zionism. As it stands, the definition of racist Jewish person seems stupid and, like I said, based on the protocols.
And once again, one of the most terrifying and awful things that has happened in the intervening time, he's a big fan of racist Jews now. He loves Netanyahu. Netanyahu is the canary in the coal mine.
He
loves racist Jews.
He has a conflicted relationship with Netanyahu.
He's got a difficult...
The canary in the coal mine was 6 years ago.
Yeah, I know. Whatever. I don't even know where... I'm unstuck in time. I'm Kurt Vonneguting it today.
Okay. So the 27th comes along, and we only have a few clips of this, too, because he just takes some calls, and it's kind of boring.
Sure.
He's in a bit of a holding pattern here. But he is pretty hardcore on the ADL is creating anti-Semitism arc here.
Okay.
And I can't believe what the anti-Semites have done, and I mean the ADL and others. They really are creating anti-Semitism like no one else could. All the Klan members and all the Aryan Nation members, all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't do this, but the ADL and others could. And I heard that Rabbi Daniel Lappin on the radio today, and he's the guy that wrote the editorial a few days ago, and he said it. He said this is these so-called Jewish groups are the ones really causing a problem, because nobody would have thought ill of, you know, Jews, because Jews and the Romans were involved in killing Christ. It was, you know, the corrupt government. But to have them saying, Mel Gibson, you're blackballed, it's over for you, you'll never work in this town again, you're not going to get any support, by major production companies that Mel Gibson has made hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, he's a major commodity. Every film he's done has been a success. Did you know that? He's the only person in Hollywood, and I've read this in entertainment publications, who's never had a failure. Very interesting.
Yeah, that's not true.
Is that interesting?
No.
I don't think that's interesting.
It's pretty crazy, though, to look back through Mel Gibson's filmography. Like, he was in a ton of hits pretty consistently.
Yeah.
You got the Mad Max series,
sure.
The Lethal Weapon series, Maverick, Braveheart, Pocahontas.
Yep.
It's nothing to sneeze at in terms of box office.
His 90s were a...
That being said, there are also some not-so-successful movies in there that Alex has just forgotten about. For instance, in 1984, he had The River, that lost $7 million at the box office. The Year of Living Dangerously lost about $3 million. His take on Hamlet and The Man Without a Face barely broke even, but let's not forget that Mel's most recent movie at this point was Signs. That may have done pretty well at the box office, but it bombed in my heart.
Yeah, yeah.
How dare you? He had a pretty good track record, but, you know, he's like a lot of top-tier actors. There are some whiffs in the mix, but generally their star power is enough to make the money back. And you just kind of forget about those ones that people do that, unless they're, like, super embarrassing, or they lead to the end of someone's, like, stardom.
Yeah.
You generally forget about the like, stray films that just didn't work out.
Right.
Alex is pretending that Mel is the only sure thing in Hollywood to make it seem like even more of a self-defeating move for people to not want to work with him. And I guess if Alex thinks it's bad now, just wait until he sees how few people want to hang out with him after that DUI.
Oh, boy.
Things get real bad then.
Yep. He turns into a character actor. Yeah. Alex, he turns into a character actor.
So, you know, you've got this idea that the ADL is creating this backlash.
Yeah.
And they're creating the anti-Semitism through their pointing out of anti-Semitism.
Right.
And just to give a little example of how serious Alex is taking this, I present to you him reporting on an article that he doesn't even know if it's real.
And I'm going to go to some calls, but later I'm going to read this article. I don't know if this is a real article, because I can't find Capital Press in Google or anywhere on a search engine. I can't find Jews Against Anti-Semitism anywhere. And occasionally there are fake news articles that come out.
Occasionally.
There's a few other telltale signs. There is a typo in it. But, I mean, I don't doubt it because I've seen stuff like this in the past, but I'd like to find out if this is a real story. And it says, Jewish groups call the Passion an act of terrorism. A prominent Jewish, and this is supposedly from Capital Press, whoever that is, a prominent Jewish organization has denounced Mel Gibson, The Passion, as an act of terrorism and can prove the movie violates the Patriot Act.
Yeah, so Alex is so desperate to cover stories of, like, things that he can say, like, oh, these Jewish
They're
groups are
control.
Inciting
yeah,
all this,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
like, that he's covering a story that even as he's covering it, he can't even get himself to say, I believe this and I this is true.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of this is true, but hey, it suits the narrative.
That is what
Fuck
he said,
it.
And that's bananas.
Yep.
That's bananas.
It's irresponsible.
I mean, you... Okay.
It definitely shows that he reports what he wants to be the narrative.
I mean, I guess you have to report it like, listen, I know this isn't true.
Then stop.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I after you say, I don't know if this is true, you should just stop.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I mean, it's not like when I'm just throwing shit out there. No. I don't know if it's true, but I'm not reading something that I'm about to present to you as a good argument.
No, it's always fine to like spitball some stuff or like some ideas, talk out an idea.
Yeah.
But it's not really great to cover news articles on your news show with the preface of this could be bullshit.
And there's a few telltale signs, like I've never heard of where it's from, and there's a bunch of typos in it. Seems like this might be a prime example of a fake thing.
Yeah, and it sounds like exactly the kind of thing that someone in my community might write with the Patriot Act stuff. And,
Wow, this really fits right into what I believe, almost as if somebody who believes exactly what I believe wrote it.
Hmm.
Odd.
It's probably true, though, because I've seen so many other things.
I see it all the time. This is just, if this is fake, it's just a good fake.
Such a good fake.
Yeah.
So we have one last clip, and it's a caller who wants to ask Alex about old Hutton Gibson and maybe some other things that Hutton has said have come out by this point.
Uh-oh.
Because Alex has a little bit of a different answer.
Bob, where are you calling us from?
I call from Idaho, Alex. How are you?
Good.
Hey, I've been listening to you for a couple of years, and I love you like a brother. You tell the truth right on. But I disagree with you on one point. But
okay.
First, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the Passion. I went to see that on Wednesday. A very moving film. All Christians should go see that movie. It's incredible. It's causing quite a stir, as you're well aware, with the Gibson family, Hutton Gibson and Mel, of course. But particularly, they seem to be after Hutton. And because of his views on the Holocaust and these types of things. So.
Yeah, he never told me those views. I've asked him about that a year ago, and he said something different. So
he did?
Sure did, yeah. So
he's not backing down, is he?
No, I just told you about a year ago.
Uh-huh. Well,
I was first talking to Hutton. I said, you know, I've heard this. And, you know, Hutton Gibson says the Catholic Church is corrupt. Hutton Gibson thinks, and rightly so, that almost everything is infiltrated.
It is. He doesn't like Hitler.
You can ask him about that.
Oh, cool.
You're speaking to the wrong audience. This guy is trying to tell you how great it is that Hutton denies the Holocaust all the time.
Yeah. He's not backing down.
He's not backing down, is he? Oh, is he about to tell me that the Holocaust happened? Because I do not agree.
But I think that's why Alex keeps talking.
He's starting to get an inkling.
And register, Holocaust denier on the phone. So the weird thing is Alex is kind of distancing him a little bit from those ideas and from Hutton being a Holocaust denier, you know, just being like, I talked to him, I didn't know this stuff. But then he's also making excuses for it and being like, he thinks everybody's corrupt.
He
talks himself all the way around to they're just saying this stuff to attack Mel.
Yeah.
And Alex is, I guess, fine with it.
I mean, there's...
But why wouldn't he be? Everyone around him is a Holocaust denier.
Exactly. That he believes it happened is under debate, but I guess is possible.
He has not given like concrete reason to think that he doesn't.
Yeah.
But if he does believe the Holocaust happened, he is a minority in his the people who are on his show.
Yeah, when he goes to a party,
Yeah.
There are very few people who agree that the Holocaust happened at that party.
Yeah.
If any.
I mean, I think we've talked about this before, but it bears repeating that it is just surprising how much of this is just on full display.
It's been there
in 2004.
From the beginning.
Yeah. I think the world could have done with like a better understanding of what this was at that time. And it could have cut some of this off at the pass and like really restricted Alex to a place where he was understood to be what he is, which is, you know, fairly Stormfront-ish, you know, maybe not as bad and explicit and, you know, dangerous as that, but maybe Stormfront light, like, sprinkle front.
You know, I'm going to say, I think one of our big problems with this is actually parental advisory lyrics, that kind of
Dipper
thing.
Gore.
I mean, no, not really, but.
Who fought against
the
those?
The fact that we can use euphemisms as though they're not the same words, mm-hmm. you know, like, oh, no, you can't say fuck, say fridge.
Right.
That's absurd, and it doesn't make any sense, and that is also why we are allowed to get people like Alex who say the exact same shit, mm-hmm. but they use euphemisms, and so you go, oh, well, that's acceptable.
Yeah, you hide behind the plausible deniability slightly different language.
I say fudge you, I fucking mean it, you know? Uh-huh. Like, that's the idea here, and when he says, oh, you know, Hutton, he thinks the Catholic Church is corrupt, he's saying the same thing.
He's saying that, the Holocaust didn't happen as we understand it, but everybody's corrupt.
Exactly.
Like, okay.
Yeah, that's not good. That's not good enough.
No.
That's not good enough. You are either agreeing or saying it is okay.
Especially in the context of just earlier in this episode, he's talking to Colonel Don de Grand Prix, who believes that the Holocaust was faked to gain the sympathy of the West.
Totally.
For Jewish people, so they could more easily take over society.
Yeah, I mean.
So, what are we doing?
That's why it's an even more insane argument, especially in their world, is because the argument isn't like, oh, did the Holocaust happen or not? You can be on the spectrum. The argument is, should we be mad at Jews for the Holocaust?
Yeah, some of those folks definitely have that.
I mean, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even if you think it's real, it's like, well, yeah, but it's their fault they did it. And you're like, what?
Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Oh my God!
Messy.
Ugh.
So much for going back to the past for a break,
right?
Jesus,
damn it!
Buddy,
we can't win.
No, Alex liked Passion of the Christ though, and I hope that chapter has come to a close because it seems like these 2004 episodes, it's been kind of a like game of like build up towards the crescendo, and hopefully that's this.
Yeah, that
because I can't take much more of him yelling about the ADL creating anti-Semitism by critiquing Mel Gibson.
Jeez. Tired of it.
Yep. Anyway, we'll be back.
Indeed we will.
But until then, Jordan, we have a website.
Indeed we do. It's knowledgefight.com.
Yep, we're also on Twitter.
We are on Twitter. It's @knowledge_fight.
Yep. We'll be back. But until then, I'm Neo. I'm Leo. I'm DZX Clark.
And now here comes the sex robot.
Andy in Kansas, you're on the air. Thanks for holding.
Hello, Alex. I'm a first-time caller. I'm a huge fan. I love your work.
I love you.